just this whole process of going through the baby boom's history, I began to realize what a nicer society, kinder, more decent society we live in today than the society when I was a kid.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with P.J. O'Rourke, the great libertarian humorist. His most recent book is The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. P.J. O'Rourke, thanks for talking.
Well, you're very welcome.
Early on, you talk about the difference of the baby boom and other generations. What makes the baby boom different from other generations is the way everybody was feeling we could be or do anything. What unifies the baby boom is the way we talked everybody into letting us get away with it.
Yes. So, I do laugh at my own joke.
Somebody has to, right?
Right. That's right. That's right.
Where did the feeling that the baby boom could be anything or do anything come from?
Economics.
Okay, let's talk about that because explain that a bit more.
I actually do a little research for this book. And one of the things I found out was that in inflation-adjusted dollars, the median family income for baby boomers was $10,000 a year more than the median family income for greatest generation.
And this is the generation that was born, maybe raised in the Depression, fought World War II.
That's right.
And these are our parents, actually.
Our parents,
I'm a baby boomer as well, or people's grandparents. And you know, they grew up in a pretty grim world.
They did, and not only were they poorer, and of course faced a number of impositions on their freedoms, such as the Depression and war. When you look at the GDP per capita, for the greatest generation, it goes sharply down after World War I, way up in the 1920s, then even more sharply down, and for a long time, during the Great Depression, and then only starts to ramp up as we begin to rearm. That's not the kind of economic ramp up you want.
Right.
You put those two things together, simply the fact that baby boom children had more money, their families had more money, and the stability of that money. If you look at GDP per capita from 1946, really to the Arab oil embargo, it's a steady upward ramp.
Right.
So the greatest generation suffered both from relative poverty and from income insecurity.
You're making a crass Marxist argument here, right? That a certain economic base, more wealth, gives you a certain cultural superstructure, which is you feel like you can do anything.
Absent externalities.
Right, yeah.
And the period when the baby boom grew up was, until the Vietnam War, largely absent of externalities.
Was it the parents who were telling their kids, you know, that you can be anything, or was it the kids who were saying, look at me, I've got money in my pocket and I'm 5 years old, I'm going to become Superman?
We didn't know that. Yeah. I mean, you know, you can only know the conditions that are around you. We had, children have not too much sense of futurity and no sense of history. So so we didn't feel that, but our parents were urging us to act out a lot of things that they themselves felt, that they felt they never got a chance to do.
Right.
Whether it was go to college, whether it was start a business, whether it was playing the trombone or whatever. They're saying, you know, you can be anything you want, which in the case of my dad meant I could be an engineer. Mm-hmm. They're saying you can be anything you want, and we thought, whoa! Drunk, stupid, stoned.
Right.
The message of the greatest generation to the baby boom got through all too well.
Did they resent the fact that people your age, you know, you did get to go to college, you did get to do drugs and live a dissolute lifestyle, you did get to have premarital sex openly? And then, I mean, were they aghast because that was immoral, or were they pissed because you actually did what they wanted to do?
I think it was more pissed than aghast. Yeah. You know, after all, they were veterans of the war and the wartime era. And come on, tell me that, like, when a guy was going off to Iwo Jima, that he spent the last night with his girlfriend on the front porch swing, cuddling mildly.
You talk about, you know, what unifies the baby boom is the way we talked everybody into letting us get away with it. And so it wasn't a particularly hard sell, or did
it really wasn't, in a sense. I mean, society was moving in a very permissive direction. Whatever great Victorian inhibitions between the Depression and World War II, yeah, and to a certain extent the Cold War. Those things were already under attack.
Obviously, it was a fight enjoyable to fight, but was it worth, you know, is it better to live in a permissive society than a repressive,
you know, to
one?
Be determined. That's probably a question that needs to be asked 100 years hence. There were a couple of blowbacks from the permissive society, one of which drugs. Mm-hmm. While, you know, I'm libertarian, I'm theoretically at least in favor of drug legalization. Right. Nonetheless, to say that drugs did not have, that the widespread drug use didn't have a deleterious effect on American society would be a palpable lie.
What are the obvious effects of that?
Marijuana did turn out to be a gateway drug, not in the sense that people who smoked marijuana went on to heroin, right, or crack, but a gateway drug in the sense that once you lower the social shaming and social inhibition against one drug, the others do tend to sneak through the door. A society that winks at smoking marijuana or even applauds it is probably asking for a little bit of trouble with abuse of drugs that really
do. So Cheech and Chong, when you convene your Hague Court of War Criminals, Cheech and Chong will be up there?
Well, far be it from me to, of all,
yeah, I think
people,
you might be in the dock.
No,
right?
So, I'd be in the docks with them. No, so I'm not blaming them. But marijuana is fine with me. It's I've got teenage daughters. This is a drug that makes teenage boys drive slow.
That's right.
Maybe it does some little brain damage, but so does almost everything else that a teenage boy
does. The chapters where you talk in the baby boom about your drug use in college and after. Yeah. Are very funny and very insightful, but you also make a special case that beer was the drug of choice of the baby boom.
Well, sure, beer was always the fall. Beer was always the fallback. You know, probably always will remain. Yeah. Alcohol will remain the fallback drug because it makes you uniquely stupid while remaining pretty mobile.
Right.
You know, there are drugs that will make you more stupid than beer. But you can't move.
You said one of the other great kind of cultural contributions of the baby boom to American kind of pop culture thinking is that life is like high school. This is kind of a framing device of the book. Talk a little bit about that.
What we think about when we think about high school is the way people self-organize. Mm-hmm. And I'm a Hayekian. I truly believe in human self-organization. But I don't have a perfect faith that self-organization is always a good thing. Maybe that was simply because I was shoved in my locker a lot.
I'm guessing that Hayek wasn't exactly the captain of the football team.
I'm guessing Hayek got shoved in his locker a lot too, but he came out of it, you know, with an admirable faith.
He used that time when he was trapped in his locker to think.
He did. Yes, he did. Instead of pound on the door, and. Of course, the thing here is Hayek's real point is not that self-organization is wonderful. It's that it's preferable to being organized by others. And of course, anybody who's been through high school would say that, you know, if it came to like dealing with the mean girls versus dealing with the principal, pick the mean girls every time, you know. So, you know, that brings us back to another jury is out area of the permissive society, which is the breakdown of the traditional family structure. Remarkable number of kids are born out of wedlock. Remarkable number of kids are raised by a single parent, usually a financially pressed mom. Mm-hmm. And is this a good thing?
Right.
People seem to be surviving this better than, you know, somebody in the 19th century would suppose.
Well, and crime, you know, youth crime is down. School bullying is down. I mean, there are a lot
down,
of positive.
It's down, but it's down after being very up for a long time. You know, I mean, it's down essentially because, the baby boom had a lot to do with youth crime. And we're aging out.
Yeah.
You know, the youngest baby boomers are turning
50. Any minute now, right?
Yeah.
Do you think there's a kind of social learning curve then, in the same way, say, to keep it with beer or pot, that, you know, as an individual, there's a learning curve in, like, how to drink beer and how not to drink it too fast or too slow?
We see
Is society
that,
like that?
We see that with crack cocaine, which was panicking the nation for about a decade or so, and its use is way down. Its use is way down essentially because a younger generation of kids watched an older generation destroy themselves with crack cocaine. Now we have an opiate problem. It seems to have originated in overprescription of pain pills. and then which are very expensive, even you know, and even more so on the black market, which has in turn driven people to heroin as a cheaper alternative. And this is making this is happening in rural areas where I live.
The governor of Vermont earlier this year devoted his State of the State address to how there was a nearly doubling the number of heroin deaths. And when I actually looked at the numbers, and it was something like it went from 8 to 14 in the state of Vermont. Yeah. So it's kind of like, is this just one more, hey, kids, don't do drugs hysteria?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it will have, cracked it, a natural cycle. The younger generation will come along and see that an older generation of kids have destroyed their lives with this. This is a huge human price to pay, though, to wait these things out. I'm not sure there's anything else to do, but still a big price.
Towards the end of the book, you say, given all the liberties the baby boom has taken, we ought to be libertarian. We should be adhering to the Clinton rules, that is, the rules that the Clintons exemplified. Mind your own business and keep your hands to yourself. Hillary, mind your own business. Bill, keep your hands to yourself. Yeah. It's a good line, but then, you know, let's focus on, you know, Reasons, a libertarian organization, a magazine. You've been a long adjunct scholar at Cato Institute. Yeah. Is America more libertarian now? Is it about the right?
We are certainly more libertarian on a social level, things like gay marriage. Yeah. But are we libertarian on, I mean, we elected Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. Are we libertarian on the fundamental government issues, which in some ways are more important than the social issues? Mm-hmm. I hate to say that because
Are economic issues, fiscal issues more important than
not
social
economic issues, but political issues are because you create a political situation that is much harder to modify, escape from, change than social situations. So this is, again, Hayek's argument is that while we may not self-organize well, when people organize for us, it's always a mess. And so we're creating a national political system upon which everybody is dependent. Right. And in fact, the liberals seem to be working very hard to make sure that everybody, you know, old people, young people going to college, anybody who has any medical problems, that everybody is dependent upon the state. And this is ultimately more dangerous than like an individual state.
This tendency is being pushed by baby boomers.
Not
exclusively.
But not exclusively.
How does that match up with kind of a high 60s
liberation? It doesn't. This is one of the things that puzzles me. Yeah. Although you would think that after Vietnam War and after the sort of exuberance of the 60s that the baby boom would be strongly libertarian in its political orientation. I think there are two things that have kept that from being true. Three, really. Mm-hmm. One is that dependence that has been fostered since at least the New Deal, if not the progressive movement more than a century ago. Another is that at a crucial time in our political education, big federal government was on the right side of an extremely important, vital question, which was
civil rights.
Yeah.
Well, talk about that, because among libertarians, you see libertarians step in it all the time of how, you know, if the cost of being free means having large parts of the country segregated, that's a price I'm willing to pay with.
It's not a price I'm willing to pay.
Right.
It really isn't.
That.
So. We watch the federal government battle conservatives and indeed libertarians. I mean, Barry Goldwater famously wrong-footed himself by supporting states' rights, not because he was a racist, but on constitutional principles. And, those constitutional principles were butting up against a really ugly reality, and there are times when you simply have to make the best of the situation as it is. And so Barry Goldwater was wrong about that. And it not only did it cost him votes, but it cost the whole reputation of the conservative libertarian movement. There was, in Paleolithic conservatism, quite a bit of racism, anti-Semitism. Bill Buckley, basically devoted his life to trying to get that stuff out of the conservative movement.
Even as until late into the 60s, National Review was still talking about how segregation was not always a bad thing.
So, that's right.
I mean, even
that's
he right. had... Yeah. Had trouble really waving goodbye.
He did. He did. You know, he managed to get the anti-Semitic nuts, right. and the worst of the. He defended McCarthy for a while, but when he realized the guy was really a nut, who had grabbed hold of a real problem, but distorted it and perverted it. People had slow learning curves on this sort of stuff, and so we watched the federal government step in and do something about this. And I think we were now at the same time we also watched the federal government conduct the Vietnam War, and you would think that would outweigh the other, but one had to do with the permanent structure of American society, the other had to do with a military misadventure. Plus, our parents really saw the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt as being heroic. Mm-hmm. Not heroic in the sense that it actually worked, but and here was at least somebody trying to do something about the Depression. Of course, he wasn't doing the right thing. And of course, people have long forgotten that much of the stuff that he did had been started by Herbert Hoover himself, a progressive Republican. But nonetheless, they came away with a feeling that the federal government was benign. They might be personally quite conservative. They might even vote. Certainly, they voted for Ike, rather than Stevenson. But they still had a feeling of that the federal government was beneficent.
It's easy to kind of create a heroic enterprise of the federal government or of a communal society where it's like we're throwing everything we can against poverty, we're throwing everything against racism, Islamofascism. Yeah. A real problem with the kind of libertarian point of view seems to be that it has trouble coming up with, we're fighting for freedom so that we can sell our artisanal cheese. We can sell raw milk directly to people without bullshitting around.
Yeah.
Is there a way to craft a kind of heroic vision of libertarianism that really gets the majority of people pumping in that direction?
It's tough, or it would have been done by now, because there is a strong streak of American libertarianism. And if libertarianism were easy to explain, and if it weren't easy to exaggerate, the effects of libertarianism, people wandering around with legalized heroin buttons and so on, I think it would have been done already. Certainly enough smart people have, I'd like to think you and me included.
One of us.
have applied themselves. Yeah. I mean, Charles Murray, many, many very intelligent people have applied themselves, Ed Crane, to crafting, sort of an agenda that people could grab a hold of. But the problem is, of course, is that libertarianism isn't political.
Right.
It's kind of anti-political, really. It wants to take a lot of things out of the political arena. It isn't ideological. Or when it is ideological, when you get a hold of excessively pure libertarians, it can be a little...
Sure.
And
we are taping this, by the way, at Freedom Fest. So
we are.
That's right on the front burner right now.
And we're taping this in Las Vegas, which is probably not the best example of people doing exactly what they want.
Is that for you kind of the core selling proposition of libertarianism that it takes things out of the political arena?
Yes, it
squeezes
does.
Politics down, because there are places where we need a consensus and we all need to be on the same page.
And we need a government. I covered Mogadishu.
Right.
Anytime I talk to an anarchist, I say, let me just take you over to Mogadishu and see anarchy at work.
So the essence is really kind of removing as many things as possible from an arena of coercion or of forced consensus to kind of self-organization.
And of course, this is a practical matter, too, when you task the government, any government, but you task, say, the federal government, with righting all wrongs, fixing all things, making everything swell for everybody, it physically just can't be done.
How many millennial children do you have?
Three. I suppose.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've got one born 97, one born smack on 2000, and one born 2004, so I guess they all count.
One of the things that is great about this book and your work in general is that it is deeply rooted in, I don't even want to say it's deeply rooted in history. It's just, it's kind of like dipped in history.
Mm-hmm. Very much intentionally, yeah.
Millennials, maybe it's because of the internet or something, but do you feel like they're more connected to a sweep of history? They seem to be more globalized, that they understand
there's
a world
out there. Well, they're much more globalized,
but
no, actually, yeah. Because what happens with the internet is that it fragments information. Hmm. In the trying to get information, you know, to write our school papers and so on,
right.
We would, of course, be copying from the World Book or whatever.
Yeah, my parents had bought the Encyclopedia Britannica, so
I
was an A student.
You were copying from the good stuff, you know, the stuff teachers hadn't even read. But on our way to trying to find out something, we ended up finding out a lot of other things. And so I wish I could remember who this was. Somebody said something very wise about the internet. So you do not question the internet. You depose it.
Hmm.
And the internet tells you only what you ask.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
So if you just type in riots in Brazil, you get the entire history of riots
in
Brazil. This is not what you meant.
You know?
This is like, you know, a Brazil.
If you're
not careful, you go Brazil defeats Germany, and you find out that Brazil was an ally of the U.S. during World War II, and Germany defeats Brazil. And this, so you end up with mosaic information.
Yeah.
Now,
mm-hmm.
I think over the time, the kids put these mosaics together, but
right.
I don't think the internet itself lends itself to... Mm-hmm. sweep of history.
Well, you mentioned in the book that you feel like the baby boom not only used up all the drugs, but used up all the peculiar, all the weird. I forget the exact phraseology.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's just that every generation of adolescent kids has to do something to shock their parents. I mean, it's just, you know, this is something that's been going on for, you know, it's mentioned by the ancient Romans.
I was going to say, you know, I think Cain and Abel shocked their parents
Cain, definitely.
Yeah.
Yes, there is something to the baby boom having used up all the weird so that now kids have to, like, hurt themselves badly on skateboards and get piercings and face tattoos and so on in order to...
But don't you got to kind of love that, right? When your kids come home with a face tattoo, you're going to be like, you know what? I got to give it to you.
I think personally, at my house, that's probably not going to work that way. But in the abstract, I appreciate their efforts to set themselves apart.
Well, then did we kick free of a certain kind of historical cycle with the baby boom where it's, you know, and you know, what's funny is that the book is, you know, I mean, it's caustic towards the baby boom. It has a lot of fun. But in the end, you really do... kind of come down on the idea that no, the baby boom is the real greatest generation.
I wouldn't go quite that far,
but you're very appreciative.
I am,
and
in the end I come around. I actually started the book hostile to the baby boom, and in the end came around to the fact that a lot of the problems the baby boom has caused are simply demographic. You can't blame that on anybody. Low birth rate before the baby boom came along, low birth rate afterward.
Right.
And,
although the baby boom, I suspect you agree with this, really owes it to the next generation to figure out how to get off the government tit in terms of Social Security, Medicare, so that our kids are not paying for us.
But it doesn't look like we're delivering on that. That's one of the things that started me off hostile to the baby boom. But in the end, I think I realized, you know, just this whole process of going through the baby boom's history, mm-hmm. I began to realize what a nicer society, kinder, more decent society we live in today than the society when I was a kid, you know. It's been years since I've seen a bar fight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think my 10-year-old boy has ever been in a fist fight. Mm. I don't think, you know, there may have been a little scuffling, but I don't think he's ever had that kind of violent confrontation. It was simply... part of the package when I was a kid.
Let me talk about a slightly different cycle of over time, which is of your journalism career, which is also covered in depth in the book and is kind of great and parallels a lot of things. You more or less got your professional journalism start working for an underground weekly when they were still called underground.
I don't know if professional would be but I got my start. Yeah. Yes,
at a magazine called Puddles.
Well, actual name I changed.
Oh, okay, I'm disappointed.
But its name was every bit as bad. It was called Harry, and not even Hairy. It's Harry.
In the context of the book, you call it Puddles.
Yes.
You write, combat was edited, combat, which is the great World War II underground
real underground
resistance
public,
paper. Combat was edited by Albert Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre. Puddles was edited by Harry, Bob, and me. Combat was in constant danger of being raided by the Gestapo seeking vicious reprisals. Puddles was in the occasional danger of being raided by Baltimore cops.
For drugs.
Yes.
not for free speech.
Underground newspapers or alt-weeklies kind of started in the 50s, but they became one of the defining media of the 60s.
Yeah. They were quite
Talk
popular.
A little bit about what it was like to work for an alt-weekly, you know, back in the day.
Great place to get started because there was no quality control whatsoever. Mm-hmm. We had to fill up a newspaper and put it out once a week. And, of course, it didn't quite get out once a week because I can't remember whether it would finally get published when we were out of marijuana and needed to buy some more, or whether it would not get published when we got some marijuana because we were too stoned to do anything. But at any rate, it gave you a chance to do all sorts of things and in any sort of grammar that you wanted. And so it was a great training ground in a way, although the end product was pretty dreadful.
You moved on from there, you know, and I'm skipping over some stuff, but to National Lampoon.
Yeah, National Lampoon was really my first real job in the early 70s.
National Lampoon was a massive magazine.
It was
a cultural touchstone. It changed the way that people felt they could talk about, you know, kind of sensitive topics and, you know, ideals and things like that. Talk about your experience at National Lampoon, how you came to be there, and then what was the essence of it? And did that demonstrate some great kind of boomer juice in American
society? It did. I came to work there because I wanted to be a writer. I moved to New York, and basically I hung around the office until they gave me some sort of job, pestering people, you know, and trying to write in a Lampoon style. It was my first experience with people who were really well-educated, doing kind of the thing that we were doing with the underground newspapers, but much more apolitical, much more just sort of, it was, National Lampoon was there to just, all tearing down, no building up.
Arguably the greatest magazine cover of all time, you know, by this magazine or the We'll Shoot This Dog.
Yeah.
Ads, I mean, what I remember is if Ted Kennedy was driving a Volkswagen, he'd be president by now.
That's right.
Your own photo funnies that you'd run in as well as, what was your most scabrous essay that you wrote or piece that you wrote for the for?
Probably mine was How to Drive Fast on Drugs While Getting Your Wing-Wang Squeezed and Not Spill Your Drink.
Right.
Libertarian cry from the heart.
You know, Maddie Simmons, the publisher, in his book about the about the magazine's history, he kind of identifies you as a turd in the punch bowl because of your politics. National Lampoon, at its best, I mean, it's kind of like The Onion or The Daily Show. At its best, it takes on all targets equally
and
cuts everybody down.
Long before I was in charge, we ran a cover of famous Che Guevara poster with him getting a pie in the face.
That's
that was a nothing sacred, nothing is sacred issue.
Do you feel like possibly American humor or American kind of avant culture, at some point it decided instead of being kind of thoroughgoing and, you know, making fun of everybody, punk music was kind of like this. It was very broad based in its target.
Yes, totally.
And then it you know, there was this
rocket
moment,
to Russia.
Yeah. Then there was this moment where we're gonna be avant garde, but we have to be politically de rigueur in a very specific way. Was there something that caused that, or is that a misperception?
Oh, no, I don't think it's a misperception. What caused that is show business. In fact, what killed off the Lampoon was the movies, essentially. In 1978, Animal House came along, and it resulted in almost everybody who was involved in the National Lampoon getting offers for movie or television or something or other. And then, of course, what had already been going on was Saturday Night Live. Anyway, all of a sudden the talent pool is getting sucked. When the Lampoon had started, there really wasn't much a way to make, it was the only game in town in terms of making a living making fun of things. All of a sudden,
you say that like, you know, there was only one. I'm kind of like, you know, it's kind of great that there was at least one place to make fun of.
Yeah, I mean, you could go to MAD, but that was more for kids. The New Yorker had lost its sense of humor someplace back in the early 50s or something. There really was, and so people who wanted to make fun of things for a living were like drawn to National Lampoon.
And then you moved to Rolling Stone, which is fascinating because your work there, it's like a masterclass for journalism. And it's kind of the later edge of the new journalism where it's heavily reported. It is serious work. It's funny. It's totally readable. How did you go from kind of, you know, writing stories about getting your wing wang squeezed without spilling a drop to, you know, going to Mogadishu and going on raids with the Guardian Angels and things like that?
1980, Doug Kenny died, and he was the guy who had basically brought me in to the National Lampoon. He was my best friend there. But the other thing was that he was, and it's funny to say it now, but it sounded old at the time, he was 33. Mm-hmm. And I was a year younger than Doug, and so I was 32, and I thought, you know, this making fun of everything is a lot of fun, and I do enjoy it, but it's kind of a kid's game, you know? I mean, it's kind of standing outside in the flower garden, peeking in the dining room window, making faces at the grown-ups. And isn't maybe it time to have a place at the grown-up table, you know? So I said, do I want to keep doing this for the rest of my life? And I laughed, and I tried some movie stuff, and I just didn't like the world. Mm-hmm. I had a good time. It paid well. I worked on Rodney Dangerfield's first feature movie, Easy Money, but I just didn't like the world. Yeah. I didn't like the world. I didn't like the sort of oppressively collaborative. Anyway, so out of the blue, Michael Kinsley, who was then editor of Harper's, asked me to go to Russia, USSR, with a group of leftists. It was a cruise sponsored by The Nation, and he thought it would be very funny for me. Michael and I knew each other a little bit, and he knew what my politics were, and he thought it would be pretty funny to send a Republican along.
It helped to find Rolling Stone in that period, but also kind of what it meant to be a new journalist, somebody who was interested in telling stories using fictional devices, being present.
I mean, it's always fun to be in on the beginning of things, but it was fun to be on the tag end of the new journalism because I could learn from its errors. I used fictional devices, but I never used fiction.
Right.
I mean, I kept strictly to the rules of reporting while putting some life in, like, not denying my own role as an observer.
Right.
The Heisenberg principle that, you know, by observing anything, you change it. It could allow for all that and not have to do AP-style copy.
Right.
But, you know, new journalism had been around long enough that I, you know, could...
Who were your, you know,
excesses.
As you were developing as a writer, who were the, who were your models, or did you have such?
I don't know if I really did, but I would say that Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson, of course, impressed me.
What I always find interesting about Wolfe is that the story is never about him. It's always he's researching
stuff.
Then Thompson, I think.
It's all about him.
Yeah, and yours actually threads that needle pretty neatly because you're there and you're an interesting character, but it's not just about you.
But it's not all about me,
It's serious. Yeah. And now, among other places, you write for the Daily Beast.
Daily Beast, I guess.
Of the things, I mean, that's interesting is just looking at the span of this. You start with an alt-weekly, and now you're at a publication.
Alt-weekly.
Yeah, that is only online.
Yeah.
Do you feel like over the past 40 years or so, I mean, journalism has changed? Is it getting better? Is media getting better or worse? You hear people constantly talking about, you know, there's no good writing anymore, the economic space is not there, et cetera. I mean, are you optimistic about print? Are you optimistic about media? Are these totally different beasts now?
I just don't know. You know, I'm just glad I'm not starting out now because the model that I understood, the magazine business basically, and the book publishing offshoot of that, is just so different now. And I think it is harder to make a living. It was always hard to make a living, it never paid an awful lot. But now it pays less. There are probably more outlets, but it pays less per, you know, your sort of price per word is, but look, it was never lavish. I mean, Playboy used to be famous for paying $8 a word.
Yeah.
Woo, you know, newspaper editorial sections still pay about that.
That's right.
You know, for an op-ed.
Yeah.
The business model is strange. I think it'll sort itself out in time, but the internet started by amateurs. You know, it's never really quite figured out a business model. I'm hoping that they'll get around to doing it. It's probably easier to get published today, but harder to make a living at it. Does the shift in media cause people to have shorter attention spans? Yes, I think so. You know, I think it would be hard for something like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas to blow the public away today the way that it did at the time.
To close out, you know, in the baby boom, you talk about how, you know, and I don't know if I have the exact phrasing, but it's that the baby boom didn't invent bullshit, but they became expert in it.
Yes.
And you talk about words are the pheromones of the baby boom generation.
We're very good at talking.
Has the baby boom passed that on to the rest of the world?
It seems that way. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. We certainly are a chatty and communicative society. Mm. Yeah.
And as you said, a nicer one or a kinder one,
I think so. Yeah. More tolerant. In fact, tolerance isn't even a good word anymore, because tolerance means, well, I'll put up with you if I have to, you know. It is more enthusiastic about people's differences, you know, applauding them, embracing them, as it were. And that's good.
Yeah. The author is P.J. O'Rourke. His latest book is The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. P.J., thanks for talking to Reason.
Well, thank you.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.